Hi, I'm Simon Campbell.
And I'm Susie Starlight.
Welcome to the Supertone Show. We'll be right back.
Pink Floyd. From the album The Dark Side of the Moon. They've Speak to Me, which fused into Breathe, in brackets In the Air, and On the Run. It's from their 8th studio album, released on the 1st of March, 1973, on the Harvest record label.
Well, we thought we'd do a show on this album. And it's over 2 hours, so we've got the hour today, which is side one. Next week, we're going to do the second side. We're going to throw in an extra track today, because it's only 20 minutes, of course. Because when you're putting things on vinyl and people forget about this, you've only got about 21 minutes of time on one side. So you've got to go, you know, 21 minutes on one, 21 minutes on the other. And because when you're cutting it to vinyl, not to get too technical about it, but when you're cutting it to vinyl, if you try and put too much information on one side, the grooves become too narrow. And what you do, you haven't got enough time. You don't get enough quality because the needle can't go deep enough in the groove. You don't get volume, everything else. Anyway, it's about 21 minutes. Our man, John Astley, tells me.
John.
And the first, who's the master engineer we use on all our stuff. Absolutely splendid man indeed. But he talks about this. But anyway, so going back to Dark Side of the Moon, 50 years, and it's a very special album for me because it was about the second gig that I'd ever seen live. And I saw them in November 1974.
Four.
And I'm doing, stop that. Four, yes.
It's your That's northern
the Northern
accent.
Four. The Northern not Four. I'm not some Downs house.
No, this is something you have for me because I didn't know when you'd seen them.
That's right. So I saw them at the Empire in Liverpool. And simultaneously when we release this show, there is a blog article out on our Vibes blog, which is really cool. And it talks about this in a lot more detail, but Because tonight we're actually going to talk about the music. But it was absolutely remarkable. And Pink Floyd were one of my first bands ever, because the first album I ever bought was Atomic Rooster, In the Hearing of Atomic Rooster. And then I got in a black hole. And then after that, I got very quickly into Wishbone Ash. I was at school. Read Vibes and it'll tell you all about it. But I went to see these guys. And it was just blew me away because I'd never heard anything like it. I'd never seen anything like it. Bear in mind, the second gig, the first gig was Golden Earring.
Of course.
So Golden Earring, Radar Love and all that sort of carry on. And they were, you know, a straight rock and roll band. They kicked the drum kit over at the end and all
Radar
that sort
Love.
Of. Yeah. But this was a completely different thing. It was sophisticated. There was a quadraphonic sound system in the Empire in Liverpool.
Really?
And yeah, and so when all these noises and helicopters and you'll hear during the whole record were coming in, it was coming from the back of the auditorium right the way to the front, and everybody ducked because they'd never heard anything like it. It wasn't like, yeah, everybody just ducked because they just didn't know what to make of it.
That's bizarre.
And there was a back projection screen. With films and stuff being projected onto the, it was like a circular thing. And again, on the blog, I've got some pictures of the, not the show I was at, but one of the shows. And it was just unbelievable. And I was there spellbound because the first three or four tracks that they played were not from Dark Side of the Moon. And then they played Dark Side of the Moon in its entirety. And then the encore was Echoes.
No way.
So I can't tell you, you know, how much this band and this record means to me. But, you know, many people have talked about it, you know, but there's huge, because you've been researching it, as
well,
you always do.
I know,
do.
I've kind of, it's burnt me out. I actually can't, I was saying to you before we were talking now, it's like, if you want to know all the facts and figures, just go and look up on the internet. This show's about the love of the music and the experience of the music with a little bit of fact, but chatting about how it feels, how it makes you feel, and the sort of more human side of it, which is exactly, I think why they wrote it, which is about the human condition, about the fear and about love and hope and hatred and authority and what it's like to be in pain. It was all those. It's a human record.
Well, I know Dave Gilmour said that really Roger Waters came into his own lyrically during this record, you know. And I know they sort of fell out, you know, later on and stuff. But this, to me, this, well, Medal, this one, and Wish You Were Here, to me, are the three best albums because it's really Pink Floyd at their most magnificent. And but, you know, what we're going to do, we're going to talk about, of course, the tracks as we go along. But there's a few things.
Go on, then.
Firstly, on this track, we're talking, it's all about the EMS VCS3 synthesizer, which was a new thing then.
And it looks really cool because I looked online. It was like, I want one. I think it's great.
I think an original one, it was $25,000, I think. It probably cost about $3,600 when they first came out. Well, later on, anyway.
Is that what they called the Putney?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Yeah, that's the Putney, isn't it? Because there was a Synthy or something, but the first one was the Putney.
Well, it had like a keyboard. It was like a briefcase thing. It had
a keyboard.
But it wasn't a proper keyboard. I think they were just like metal slabs and you used to put your things on it.
It was created by, I've done some research on this, just because I was really interested in the sound. In 1969, created by Peter Zinoviev's EMS company. Designed largely by David Cockerell. And its distinctive appearance was the work of electronic composer Tristram Cary. It was one of the first portable, commercially available synthesizers in the sense that it was housed entirely in a small wooden case. And like synths from American manufacturers like Moog Music or ARP or is it Buchler or Buchler? Because basically they had large cabinets and they could take up entire rooms. So
that's right.
If you think you've gone from like this electronic loop equipment that takes up a whole room and you can get it in a suitcase. And one question I want to ask you, did it feel like you'd been given audible magic mushrooms or LSD or some sort of trip when you were there seeing them live?
Well, yeah, because what we've got to remember is that back then there was no sequences. You know, to play stuff back, you had to get a tape machine on stage and play it back. Yeah. So it was all kind of live, and all this, the VCS3 and everything, if I remember correctly, and it's a long, long, long time, 50 years. But
you were there.
But I was there. But I remember hearing the sequencer, because this synthesizer, it was the first one with a sequencer. What a sequencer is, it's a way of, you hear them on old records.
Yeah.
So if you play a chord, well, we use them all, using them all the time now. Yeah, they'll come
together.
If you speed it up.
Yeah.
And there's a video, which I'm going to post a link on this, on the web page associated with this blog. I'll post a link to the video if you're interested in the gear, but it's very interesting. Anyway, so they had this on stage and it was remarkable, but Dave Gilmour for me, because I'd just started playing guitar, because that was a summer, it was the hottest summer on record, 1974, and I remember being outside at school after that, I think I'd just done my O-levels, or I'd never done my O-levels, and I remember just hanging around playing guitar and getting people to teach me chords and all that sort of stuff, and then I went to see these guys.
Wow.
And Dave Gilmour, I thought, I want to be a rock and roller. I want to be him. And, you know, he was using his Strat and he had the fuzz and all these great sounding phaser pedals. And it was just fantastic. It really, really was. And something that is a memory, which, you know, is because it's like one of the first gigs he ever went to. I know yours was, what, Stevie Wonder, wasn't it?
My first proper concert was, NEC Birmingham, Stevie Wonder.
Yeah.
16.
Well, you know, I mean, again, a titan.
Set the bar, really.
Yeah, music business.
I just thought that's the way to do it.
Yeah, well, it is.
I was right at the front. Fantastic.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, I wasn't. I was sort of halfway, but anyway, it was really cool.
But what I love about this, so we know it's 50 years old. We know it's like 14 times platinum. It topped the Billboard top LPs and tape chart. I love that. It's charted for 973 weeks.
No.
But it was only at number one for 1 week.
No.
Yeah, it sold over 45 million copies.
Ka-ching.
Exactly. So you've got all this, and it was recorded in two sessions in 1972 and 73 at EMI Studios, which is now Abbey Road in London. It was produced by the band and engineered by Alan Parsons, who'd got a job as a tape op at 18, and he worked on the Beatles' Abbey Road and Let It Be. And then he got promoted. And so he'd been working on this for a while. And then Chris Thomas came in because they wanted to, as mixing supervisor, because they wanted a fresh pair of ears as well. So you've got all this. And what, ladies and gentlemen, what we need to do is experience this album together over the next two shows, okay? And what they did is it all started in the kitchen.
No.
Yeah, it was in Camden. It was at Nick Mason's kitchen, and Roger Waters, the guys were there. Now, you hear different interview accounts, but either two or four. Anyway, in the kitchen, he came up with this concept. This is a concept album. And this is where it, and Roger Waters said, this is what I think we should do. Because after the history with Syd Barrett and doing more psychedelic stuff, and Roger Waters was more political and wanted the lyrics and just the whole thing to be more relevant to, let's take it back from outer space and bring it right back down to Earth and the human condition. And so what they did is they wrote it within a few months because they were going off on tour, and then they toured. They wrote the music, and then they toured it for a year before they recorded it.
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, so they grooved it, and they were working on how it flowed, and they changed it, and they just... So literally, they'd been around. This album was... And it's a bit like Jonathan Wilson, you know, when he did his Gentle Spirit album, he had a mixtape and he was sending it around, and it went around like the underground scene for a good year or two, or even three, before he actually released it as a proper album. Yeah, so people got to know it. And then what they did is they rehearsed at the Rolling Stones warehouse. I didn't know the Rolling Stones owned a warehouse. So they rehearsed there. I know they had the mobile truck, and also at the Rainbow Theatre. And they actually previewed the whole album a year before they released it to the press at the Rainbow Theatre in 1972.
No, I didn't know that either. These are all facts you're digging up.
Well, this is what... Because I was listening to an interview, and Dave Gilmour was saying that, yeah, they played five nights at the Rainbow, and it was called Dark Side of the Moon, A Piece for Assorted Lunatics.
Wow.
So it's like... So, I mean, all this, so you've got this whole thing, so it's all happening. They're on the road, they're experimenting, they're doing sounds. I think we should we play the next track?
Otherwise we're going to carry on.
I know, but it's so exciting. I want to get in the music.
I think the only problem with this album, though, is that you want to play the whole thing. And I think once you've listened to the show and us chunnering on about it, I think you should put it on, get your vinyl player out
lie
or
on the
CD,
floor.
Lie on the floor in the dark and listen to the whole thing again.
Thank you.
Feel embarrassed announcing the name for that track, because everybody that listens to this show will know it, and if they don't, you know, you need to sit down in the dark again,
lie on the floor,
Time, of course, by Pink Floyd from Dark Side of the Moon. This is the fourth track on the record, really, if you break it up. But they all merge into one, and it's such a shame actually breaking it up. But for the purpose of the show, we need to do it. What is very interesting about this track is the guitar employed on it.
Okay.
Because, of course, well, I don't say of course, but David Gilmour had this black Strat, which was sold in 2019 for nearly $4 million.
Give over.
The most expensive.
What?
I think it's the most expensive guitar ever, yeah. And I think he sold a lot of his collection and gave it to charity. This is Dave Gilmour. I mean, it's amazing. But that was, and that's all. But this was, the first couple of solos, I think, was actually that. But then he had a Bill Lewis custom model, which I've never heard of before, and apparently it was double cut away, like a sort of Gibson type of thing. But anyway, he used it, you know, throughout the album, but one of the solos on this. And, of course, Dave's amplification was the Hi-Watt DR.
Hi-Watt?
Yeah, 103, because you're a Hi-Watt lover. You've got your DR-201, the 200-watt
I have. Signed monster. On the inside.
Yeah, signed on the inside. By Reeves himself. But the interesting thing is about that amp is that we tend not to use it live anymore. It's an old, it's 1974, so it was probably Ooh. Built Ooh. The same year that this album was out. Have you thought about that?
No.
So that's amazing.
I've gone on tingly.
Yeah. And it could have been in the Pink Floyd arsenal or something. I don't think it was, but it could have been. But they used 100 watt versions through this 4x12 Starfinder cabinet, and we have a Superton amp, which is a Matt amp. But Matt amp now build the WEM Starfinder cabinets, and the Australian Pink Floyd use these.
That's
cabinets.
True. I remember Jeff telling us.
That's right. Yeah, Jeff Lewis. Very troublesome. Jeff Lewis.
Very troublesome. And very talented.
Yeah. So anyway, the remaking the speaker and the remaking the 4x12, and again, I'll put a link in on our thing because it's interesting if you like equipment and gear and stuff. But but the design of this record, that was the other thing, because you know it was the music, but then when you saw it for the first time, you almost had to buy it.
Yeah, the album cover. Classic. It's it was designed by Aubrey Powell and Storm Thorgerson. What a great name.
Yes,
Storm Thorgerson of Hypnosis. And during a late night brainstorm session, they came up with loads of ideas, but they had a really loose brief. The Floyd just said, look, just like minimal direction. Rick Wright said, do something clean, elegant, and a bit graphic. They had this Silver Surfer, which I think was the first thing, and they both said no. There were quite a few different designs that they put forward. But then Thorgerson had...
Sorry, you've got to say
Thor,
that.
I know. Thor. Well, you started it because you keep doing these dramatic name pronunciations.
Dramatic?
Yeah.
Okay.
So Thorgerson found a black and white photograph of the dispersion of light by a prism in a physics textbook.
Mm.
And he was thinking about relating like the triangle. So you've got like relating to Floyd's light shows were apparently fantastic at that time.
They were.
A symbol of thought and ambition and very much subject of Roger's lyrics. So as soon as they saw it, they went, yep. That's it. And then they had a gatefold originally, and they had like the heartbeat going across in the middle. So they've had all different, because at the moment we're actually designing the album cover for our new album, it takes a huge amount of thought and yet none, if you know what I mean, because if you overthink it, this is why I love this story, because you can't overthink it. You've got to run with your gut. You've just got to run with something. And when you know it, you'll feel it. So it's iconic. I mean, actually, on the front cover of The Language of Curiosity is a photo of people dancing in the street in Oxford the day after lockdown, and there's a lady wearing a Pink Floyd T-shirt.
No, I forgot Remember? About that.
Yeah. Outside Café Crème.
Yeah, that's right. Language of Curiosity is
she's
last
got a Pink Floyd T-shirt. See, it's iconic. But I love design, and I just think, everybody knows that it's, well, if you don't, you do now.
Absolutely.
It's just brilliant.
So talk about these flashcards then, because this is something that is really interesting about this.
Yeah. Do you know what really inspired me when you said about when everyone ducked at the concert? And I think when you have to almost go back in a time machine and think about what was around at the time to really appreciate. It's a bit like, was it War of the Worlds when they heard it on the radio and people were like putting tinfoil hats on their head thinking that the aliens were coming?
Yeah.
Seriously. I remember Richard Dreyfuss, you know, the guy was in Close Encounters.
Of course.
He was telling a story about that, you know, that when he listened to the radio, that was like their movie, their soundscape. Mm. And people were putting tinfoil on their heads and running down the street with towels and stuff going, oh my God, we're being invaded. So you go back 50 years and you're saying, you ducked, you didn't hear these sounds, and you've got these new machines and synthesizers and the Putney, and you've got the...
But there was sampling as well. That's the thing. Is that everything sampling is new, but you listen to, you know, a lot of this stuff, all the laughing, all the talking, there's, you know, on the next week you'll hear Money, you know, with the change and all that.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's basically just you know, samples. But what they were doing, having to do it on tape and then cutting it up with scissors and sticking it all together and running through a tape machine. You know, and it seems crazy now, but it's exactly the same process.
Yeah, it is. And so Roger Waters talks about, with his brace as well, a bass, not brace, he was pressing the string down onto the pickup to get a sound effect. So they literally, I mean, there was one album they did it before, and they were literally just making music out of household objects.
Yeah.
And they just experimented. It's like music concrete. It's like this field recording type thing. They were just trying to, without using musical instruments, make notes and getting paper tearing to get a... Mm. So they were already experimenting with this. And then when you fuse it with the sort of lyrical content that Roger Waters wanted, you've got the musical exploration. And then on top of that, Roger, very troublesomely, wrote some flashcards. And basically, it was a load of cards that had questions on them. Mm-hmm. And he put them around the studio, and you would sit down and you would read it, and then you'd speak your answer into a microphone. And so it was things like, what's your favourite colour? When was the last time you thumped someone? Why did you do it? Were you in the right? Are you afraid of dying?
Mm.
Do you think you're going mad? And what do you think of the dark side of the moon?
Wow.
And this is where, so you've got before now, there was a guy, you know the bit that says, I've been mad for fucking years, absolute years, I've been over the edge for yonks. That's actually their roadie, Chris Adamson, who now runs a sound company.
Wow.
And the laughing, that laughing, God, it's a bit eerie, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
That's their old road manager, Peter Watts. So Paul and Linda McCartney were recording next door. I think they're doing some Wings tracking. Mm-hmm. They had a go at it, but apparently Roger was saying that they tried too hard to be funny, you know, and he wanted them to be natural, so they ended up not using it. But they did use the guitarist, and his name escapes at the moment. They used they used one of his bits of speech as well.
What, George Harrison?
No, it's the Wings.
Oh, right.
Yeah,
Oh,
now
God.
I've got him. He's in the next show, actually.
Danny Lane, is it?
No, it's the other guy, McCulloch.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So he's on there as well.
Wow.
And you've got, anyway, I don't want to give too much away because we've got another show to do, and I've
trivia.
Got those. You know, it's trivia, but see, so you've got all this put together, and it's Dark Side of the Moon.
Yeah.
The Great Gig in the Sky. Pink Floyd. Stunning. The music was written by Rick Wright. And this lady, legend, Claire Torrey.
Mm.
What a voice. Absolutely stunning. It gives goosebumps, doesn't it? Like,
even now after you listen to it so many times.
I know. I don't know. It's something magical about that. So I didn't know her name until I started researching the show, because why would I? I don't know. I just never heard of her. So she used to live around the corner from Roger Waters in Richmond, and he used to see her walking her lovely white bull terrier in the park all the time. Isn't that a lovely little stuff?
Yeah.
So anyway, it's all because of Alan Parsons. She'd worked on some sessions with Alan Parsons, and he recommended that they get Claire in on the record. Now, I love this. So Alan Parsons was engineering, and he said, right, they simply said, okay, well, I know this, Greg. She did an album of covers, you know, in the early 70s.
Okay.
All those, there were loads of cover albums, weren't there?
There were, yeah.
I know. Was that like the Top of the Pops thing?
Yeah, Top of the Pops series. Pickwick was it? Pickwick.
Oh, yeah, it was.
That's right.
It was.
The record label. And they used to put them, and they emulated.
Scantily clad ladies in like gym shorts or something, weren't
that's
they?
Right,
and sort
yeah.
of like big grins and big hair. Yeah. It was really fun. Top of the Pops. So she was, she used to go into the studio and record that in a day.
All right.
So she did the covers albums. And so he said, Alan said, there was a bit of direction given. They said, sorry, we've got no words. no melody line, just a chord sequence. So just see what you can do. And that's what happened.
Wow.
So she was there for a couple of hours. She did two or three tracks. And they basically assembled the best bits for the master. And they were saying that somewhere in the archives, he probably got bits they didn't use. It'd probably be quite interesting. And do you know how much you got paid for the session?
Go on.
£30.
No.
Which is the equivalent of about £435.
Oh, dear.
But in the early 2000s, there was a little of a legal action taken, and she's now credited as one of the composers on the track because it was deemed that she...
And so she should.
She should. So bravo, Claire, and bravo, Pink Floyd as well, because actually at the time it was probably just something that they, you know, you go in as a session musician and you do your thing and you get paid your fee and that's it. But I mean, this is iconic, isn't it? So she also worked... Now, this is great as well. She carried on. She's working as backing vocalist with Matthew Fisher and Gary Brooker
from Procol Harum.
Matthew Fisher, The White Shade of Pale, original.
Indeed.
And Meatloaf, she did a duet with Meatloaf, Modern Girl.
Is that right?
Yep. She was backup vocals for Kevin Ayers from Soft Machine.
Yeah, Soft Machine, great man.
And she and Olivia Newton-Bomb.
No.
Yep. And she sang the theme. Do you remember that Butterfly? Life is like a butterfly.
Oh, yeah.
The Dolly Parton song for the TV series, the BBC. She sang that.
All right. Wow.
With Wendy Craig.
Well, there you are. That's amazing.
So there you go. Big up with Claire Torrey. What a voice. What a lady.
Well, it's amazing. And, you know, everybody talks about, you know, I mean, Claire, as I said, I could remember it. I did see her live because she actually sang it live, you know, when I went to see her in 74. But Rick Wright and Nick Mason, they always seem to get second fiddle because everybody talks about Dave Gilmour's guitar, and he is a brilliant guitar player. You know, the melody, you know, the sound, and you know, and I learned so much from him. I learned so much from this record. And Roger Waters, his inspiration, his troublesome, his lyric, his, you know, fuck you attitude, and he is a troublesome guy. But Nick Mason single handedly invented this style of drums. It's like, we call it three spliffs back drums. So you have a spliff, you have another one, then you have another one, and then you play the drums. So it's so laid back, you're virtually horizontal. It's like James Gadson or something, or something from one of the, you know, from one of those sessions, early sessions, Bill Withers sessions. You know, and earlier on, you heard just before time, the Rotor Toms, they were like, yeah, brrrr, that. Right at the very beginning. And those, he had to tune each one because they're like a rotator. Very odd thing. Look them up, Rotom.
I love that name, Rototom.
Rototom, yeah. Our first drummer, Eddie Byron Taylor III, had a set of Rototoms. Yeah, we used to take around there. We went masses of stuff. But we've always had a lot of gear. But yeah, and so, I mean, and he's so appropriate when he hits it, he means it. Yeah. And it's beautiful because without him, it just wouldn't have the groove. And Roger Waters, you know, he's a very simple bass player, but he plays all the notes in the right place at the right time. Although on here, the timing, you know, it's slippery. It's not dead on.
No.
It's not like right in.
It's
know?
Human, though, I guess.
It is very human.
Do you know what? That's really struck me as well, you know, because I love the way you love drums and bass as a musician as well, even though I know you're a guitarist. And it's like, you know, when you think about Charlie Watts is the sound of the Rolling Stones.
He is, yeah.
And it's like with the drummer actually informs the root of the band.
Yeah.
And the bass player, and having worked now with different drummers, I understand that more now because it's a different. You play differently with
you
each
do.
Other.
It's a completely different energy, yeah. And you know, there is absolutely no doubt. There wouldn't be a Who, there wouldn't be a Led Zeppelin,
no.
There wouldn't be a Rolling Stones without that. You know,
that feel.
But just coming on before yes. we're going to go to the next track because what? We're not actually playing one from the Dark Side of the Moon there because
no.
that is the first side. We've done it.
Yeah,
done it. Incredible. So we're going to have a quick talk about Rick Wright, who, again, you know, very, very underrated guy. But his playing, and he wrote that, you know, he wrote the chords in that. And apparently it starts in a B minor and ends in a B flat, which is very difficult to get to if you're technically minded from a melodic point of view, but it does. He was talking about that.
Yeah.
And his piano playing is beautiful, his synthesizer playing is beautiful, and his Wurlitzer and Rhodes playing just magnificent. It's sort of just, he's just great, so appropriate with his parts, you know. And Gilmour has all the show off, he stands at the front and everything, but all that shit that's going on in the background is all Rick Wright, and he's just an absolute genius, you know. Very sadly, you know, dead now, but amazing. And he used to control the quadraphonic knob. It's like a joystick. And what the joystick does, it moves the sound. If you imagine a joystick, there's four positions, four
like
corners.
Those are video games from like
that's
when
right.
they first started out. That little joystick.
That's
that
right.
was like that, wasn't it?
That's right. So you move it to the top left, and it'll pan the sound to the front left, top right, and the back, and all that. So you can move it around. And we were looking at buying an old Cadillac G-Series, which, you know, I wish we'd got
it. In San Sebastian, up in the mountains, in Basque
amazing
country.
Thing.
That was an amazing experience.
Amazing console. But that had the old quadraphonic.
It was really cool, actually.
Yeah, it was really cool. Great console.
So they called it, this is what I couldn't believe when I researched this, it was like, so it was constructed in May 67 by a guy called Bernard Speight, and they called
Indeed.
It the Azimuth Coordinator. Azimuth Coordinator, a.k.a. the quadraphonic panpot.
Well, Azimuth Coordinator, Azimuth is all to do with tape machines and stuff. They talk about the Azimuth. Anyway, so that's a whole different thing. But again, we've got to remember this record was done with either 8 or 16 tracks. They were bouncing things down. And I watched an interview with them in 2003 and they were talking about the 5.1 immersion edition that came out then. They were trying to sell it, obviously, to Pink Floyd. And but what they did is that they went back to the original masters tapes and actually reproduced and put it all back together again. Because the big problem when you in those days is that what you're listening to here on this record is third generation tape. It's been it's been recorded once, then it's been bounced down, so it's been moved from one tape machine to another. And every time you do that, you lose quality.
Yeah.
But apparently, this immersion, which I haven't actually, we haven't got 5.1 because we're still in stereo, you know.
Stereo. And,
anyway, we don't talk about that. But. Mm. Yeah, so there we are.
And all hands on deck, I believe, as well. So when you've got, like, your all your tracks, your channels are full up and you have to, like, then bounce it onto another tape, to get all the mixing by hand, because it wasn't automated then, as everyone, you get a load of guys and girls along the desk and their job is to ride the faders and get
as
all
we
that.
Are going to be doing in a few
exactly.
weeks for our album.
I love doing that. I love it. It's so much fun.
You say the hill's too steep. Oh,
My dad loved that track.
Did
because
he?
Because he was a Liverpool supporter.
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and my mother was a Manchester United supporter. So when there were football on, it was like skin and hair flying in the house. Anyway, that, of course, is not from Dark Side of the Moon. That is Fearless from Pink Floyd's sixth studio album, Medal, released on the 30th of October 1971 on Harvest again. The reason I played that is that, A, we needed another track for the show because it's only 20 minutes aside, as we explained earlier on. But when I first started playing guitar at 16, I used to play this because I love that da-da-da-da-da-da, and I used to play it, and that was one of the first things I really learned on guitar. And that's when I was in the garden at school and stuff, and I was playing after
it's
that.
It's a lovely piece, actually.
And I worked it out, yeah. And I just love the song. I think it's such a whimsical sound to it, and it just shows what a difference and how far that the moved. I wouldn't say progressed, because Medal is still one of my favourite albums just to One of These Days, because this was the B-side to One of These Days, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
I could have played that today, you know, or we could have played it today. It's because it's a great song. But I think this, to me, it's so personal. And if you listen to it, it's a song, and it's a beautiful song.
Yeah.
On a beautiful album. And then Dark Side of the Moon is a completely different thing. It's a progressive rock album. It's one of the first progressive, real progressive rock albums that's all joined together and all that. Should be listened in a wanna, really. And, you know, but what I love about Pink Floyd, and I think the thing about Pink Floyd that is different than, which has given them the longevity, is the songwriting. Because yeah. You can still, you know, with, you know, Money and Time and all these songs, and all of them, you can sing the melody with proper chords underneath it.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, progressive nonsense. There's no whittering, the unnecessary whittering of keyboards and guitars. It's all part of the song. It's all serving the chords and the song.
They've almost got the monopoly on clocks chiming now, because you just think of that track straight away, bling, ding,
yeah.
Ding, and then every time it goes money, ding, 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 right, and my elbows go up and I'm like a child again. It's like, because it gets you. I mean,
yeah.
The thing is, I didn't even know what all the tracks were called. I just know, I know this album. The first time I heard it, I was in Gloucester, and I was living in a house share, and I sat at the end of Aid's bed. And he said, have a listen to this. And this was this tall Italian. He must have been about 6'5".
Blimey.
He used to ride a trike. And he was such a sweet character, such a lovely chap, a real gentleman. And he said, yeah, let me play you this, you know. So it was a real trip without tripping, if you know what I mean.
And were you drinking wine at the time?
No, I don't know. Probably.
Yeah, I think there's more to the story, actually, than meets the eye. But anyway, I don't think we'll talk about it.
We'll go on about this. So, I mean, what a fantastic... So this album, they say that it's sort of... it's that transition from when it was Syd Barrett's influence group of the late 60s into the Waters-led era, or more of the Gilmore as well. Because I didn't know they were called the T-Set.
Neither did I.
No, when they started off, they had this like Mad Hatter ethos when Syd Barrett was in the band, and they played a gig at an RAF base in 65, and there was another band of the same name. So Syd Barrett then decided, quick, I've got to change the name. So he fused two inspirations together. We had Pinkney Pink Anderson and Floyd Council, and they were called the Pink Floyd Sound.
Wow.
So there you go, a bit of triv there. So, but Medal was a group effort, and the lyrics were primarily by Roger.
And sung by Dave Gilmore.
Yeah.
Well, Fearless, anyway.
And John Leckie was the tape op, apparently. So they used to start late.
Went on to excellence, John
indeed.
Leckie, of course, yeah.
But they used to start late and finish late. And they just had free run, really. And they went over to Air Studios as well, and they were doing some of those household object kind of experiments.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, so they were doing that during Medal as well. So
excellent.
You can see all the creativity.
Well, that's the end of the show, I'm afraid, for this week. Next week, we've got the second part of Dark Side of the Moon. And you can catch our blog, which is vibes.starlight-campbell.com, which is like an accompanying thing to the show, actually, because it talks about the live experience and everything. Hanging on in quiet desperation is the English way. The time is gone. The song is over. Thought I'd something more to say.